Obiang paid a handful of lobbyists to represent him in Washington. They advised him about political reforms and image management, but they had not resolved the basic problem, as he saw it, that he lacked sufficient access to the Bush administration. The oil companies operating in Equatorial Guinea told Obiang that he needed to upgrade his Washington presence. They could support his cause, but they could not conduct his lobbying for him. If ExxonMobil's Washington office, or those of Hess and Marathon, oiled Obiang's efforts to win favor from the Bush administration by becoming too directly involved in Malabo's rehabilitation, it would only discredit Equatorial Guinea further. Obiang reached out to two of the most successful lobbying firms in Bush's Washington, Barber Griffith & Rogers and Cassidy & Associates. Richard Burt, a former New York Times reporter who had served as the American ambassador to West Germany during the Reagan administration, helped to manage the Obiang account under contract for Barber Griffith. At Cassidy, one of Obiang's aides called Amos Hochstein, a young former Capitol Hill aide. Intrigued, Hochstein used Google to research Equatorial Guinea. The search returns were not particularly encouraging. He traveled to New York to meet with Obiang's prime minister, Miguel Borrico, at the Pierre Hotel. The president was in a mood for fresh thinking, the prime minister reported. Obiang had been embarking on an American strategy, as his oil wealth grew, to protect and align himself with the world's most formidable oil-consuming superpower, and yet he wasn't getting anywhere, one of Obiang's advisors recalled. You're in deep trouble, the Cassidy lobbyist told them. Hochstein was a liberal Democrat. He was uncomfortable with the account, but his firm had decided to go forward. I'm not going to lobby for you. What I can do is help you understand what you need to do to change your relationship with the United States government. I'll try to be the translator between you and the American government. Cassidy accepted Obiang as its client for a retainer of more than $1 million a year, a handsome sum in the Washington lobbying arena. The question of whether the Bush administration had winked in advance at the man-led coup plot lingered, sowing distrust and uncertainty in the U.S.-Equatoguinean oil partnership on which ExxonMobil depended. At an African counterterrorism conference for regional intelligence leaders held in Libya around this time, Obiang's director of internal security approached Mel Gamble, the Africa division chief of the CIA, and accused him outright of sponsoring the Simon Mann-led coup plot against Obiang. It was a U.S. aircraft, Obiang's spy chief pointed out. Look, you can buy a lot of things in the United States, Gamble answered. He denied that the United States had any involvement. You can buy weapons from the U.S. too, he said, but that didn't mean that the Bush administration was involved or even aware. Senior intelligence officers from Angola and Algeria overheard Gamble's pleading. They joined the discussion and backed their American colleague. Just because African coup plotters bought equipment in the United States did not mean that the Bush administration knew what was going on. They knew this from their own experiences, they affirmed. The Central Intelligence Agency had no station in Equatorial Guinea at the time of the man-led coup attempt. The agency covered the country out of a base in Lagos, Nigeria. Operations officers there might make one or two trips to Malabo each year to make contacts and survey the political landscape. Reporting on economic issues, such as oil production, had been cut back during the late 1990s. After September 11, terrorism became the CIA's overriding focus, and by 2003, the Africa Division was doing all it could to stave off the transfer of its personnel to Iraq and Afghanistan. Even at the Pentagon, which was developing new military-to-military and counterterrorism contacts in Africa's oil-producing regions, Equatorial Guinea just wasn't up there as a priority for American intelligence collection, said Teresa Whalen. We had no access. Was it credible to think that neither the Central Intelligence Agency nor the Pentagon knew about the coup in advance? South Africa's intelligence service plainly did, and Britain's picked up advance word as well. Either the United States was so obsessed with terrorism in Iraq that it did not have the capacity to pick up not-so-top-secret reporting by allies, or it did know, and successfully buried its awareness after the coup failed. The evidence from the plotters' testimony, although tainted by the circumstances of their various incarcerations, does suggest that Prime Minister Aznar was involved, or at least was informed in advance. Aznar, through his office, has denied that allegation. If Aznar was involved, it was at least conceivable that he warned the Bush White House in advance about what to expect in Malabo, using a narrow, closely held intelligence or White House channel that did not reach the wider American security bureaucracy. Even that theoretical possibility seems doubtful, however. Tipping Bush in advance would risk soliciting the White House's objection to the coup, not least because of American corporate oil investments in the targeted country. The coup attempt did catalyze the Bush administration to move closer to Teodoro Obiang Nguema. The exchange between the CIA's Gamble and his Equato-Guinean counterpart at the Libyan Intelligence Conference suggested the flavor of the administration's dilemma. Obviously, Obiang now had reason to doubt the United States. The Riggs scandal and the purchase of the coup plane from Kansas would have made anyone in his position nervous. The policy of cautious ambivalence that the administration had pursued toward Obiang's regime, notwithstanding the enormous investments in the country by American-headquartered corporations, now had to be re-examined. Among other things, if the Bush administration did not reach out quickly to Obiang, he might assume the worst about the events in March and reassess his commitment to ExxonMobil, Marathon, and Hess.